Welcome to the Deep Dive and welcome to the Inside Texas YouTube channel powered by InsideTexas.com. Please make sure you like and subscribe this video. And we do this deep dive every week and you need to be a part of our subscriber base. And of course, there's tons of other great Inside Texas content. You want it sent directly to you so you're not always having to enter that pesky URL. Make sure you like it. And we, of course, want your comments down below. Always enriching, enlightening, if not occasionally amusing. Ian, we've got some questions that we want to answer. We solicited on the Inside Texas board. The only time that I'll engage in solicitation, Ian. All right. You ready to get to these questions, my friend?
I'm ready.
All right. What? This is a bit of a chicken or the egg question, but I actually don't think it's a chicken or the egg question. I think there's a primordial prime chicken that was created from nothing that's responsible for this all. What's the biggest reason Texas is back? Sark or NIL?
I think I've actually engaged with an Aggie friend in debate over this, but I think it's Sark. It's the biggest reason.
Why?
Because if you look at Texas's recruiting classes under Tom Herman and Charlie Strong, recruiting was not the biggest problem at Texas. They were top 10 classes almost every year. I think we all agree that Sark is recruiting at a higher level than they were. He's getting a lot more of the like game-changing five-star kind of guys. But even with that, it's like Texas has to recruit in the top five to be good. That doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? Like there shouldn't be that big of the tipping point shouldn't be top five recruiting versus top 10 recruiting, especially when they were in the Big 12. It makes no sense at all. So I know you have some, I know where you're going to go with this, which is, I think I would also say is a little different, but NIL has been huge. Without the top guy, the right guy at the top, we've already seen how it gets wasted.
Yeah, the answer to this is Sark. And he's creating the NIL. Now, he's not responsible for the potential NIL. That's inherent to Texas fans being pretty successful in the world and also caring about football. That's a good combination if you're trying to fund NIL. Texas doesn't just have some rich guys, which we certainly have a lot of. We've also got a lot of upper middle class people who care about football, and they contribute their 50 a month, 100 a month, whatever it is. But Sark is the spark that inspired all of this. Under prior regimes, I don't think a Tom Herman, I don't think a Charlie Strong, I don't think a latter era Mac Brown would have fully taken advantage of this. Early Mac Brown would have killed it.
Yeah.
But the answer is Sark. And of course, the NIL, you could say, well, but I mean, look, you've got all this NIL, you've got all these resources, facilities, living alum, all these advantages of Texas, the demographics of Texas, right? None of that matters if you don't have someone who can be the spark. And by the way, we don't have a very good structural NIL system. And I mean, endorsed by the university itself. Like our athletic department does much less than y'all would think. And at times may be almost adversarial in some ways to NIL. Sark is the reason, because he reaches out personally to folks. And frankly, the average Texas fan really likes Sark, not just because of the winning on the field, but because of how he represents the university. And I think that's another spark for this. So to me, the easy answer is Sark. I agree with you, Ian. Next question.
Without a top-down strong leader, Texas devolves into the worst traits of a bureaucracy.
100%. Do we need, speaking of bureaucracies, do we need a GM at Texas to take some of the load off of Sark? So I understand the impetus for this question. The thought is Sark is having to do a lot as the head coach at the University of Texas. Are there some ways we can take the load off of him? Yes. Well, there are. This isn't the area where we want to do it. And by the way, Texas does have a GM. His name is Brandon Harris. This is the org chart. This was put together by our colleague and friend, Charlie, Coach Charlie. Props to you. And basically, this outlines how everything works. The important part of this reporting structure is that Sark is the sun upon which all other planets rotate. There is not a parallel structure at the University of Texas as there are or is at the University of Oklahoma. The GM at Oklahoma doesn't report to the head coach.
Yeah.
He reports to a rich alumni and the AD. So he lives in his own parallel structure, which is fascinating. And this is going to be a great test case to see if that works at OU.
I think that could work, but it's not going to work for them.
Do we want a structure like that at Texas?
Probably not. You only want that to work if the two guys are really good at working together.
Yeah.
When you have it where one guy gets brought in over and above the other's wishes, so and his people are all pushed out, you're not going to get a great working relationship. One guy has one vision of how you win in Oklahoma, and the other guy has probably a completely different vision of how you win in Oklahoma. Having two guys with complementary skill sets executing the same vision can absolutely work.
Yeah, I think one of Sark's underrated and underpublicized strengths is he's a pretty good player personnel guy. He knows what good looks like, and he has a real commitment, particularly to the trenches. Very different mentality from a lot of these wunderkind offensive coordinator. Oh, look what he wrote, drew up on the back of a napkin. He's a genius. That's all great. Sark is like, hey, I want to dominate you on the lines of scrimmage, and then all my plays work a lot better, I've noticed.
Like the synthesis of Cliff Kingsbury, who got a new gadget guy out of the NFL draft or the free agency pool every year.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very right. All right, so very good question, and I'm glad we could clarify this. Texas does have a GM, but we do have a different structure, a more traditional structure in which Sark is the sun upon which the solar system is revolving around. So next question. This is a great question. I love this premise. We're speaking to the gentleman who coined this term. What's the next flyover defense teams might use versus Texas now that it's semi-solved? What could a defensive mind scheme up to shrink the talent gap and challenge Sark? I have a pretty distinct opinion on this. Can you briefly explain what a flyover defense is, Ian?
The flyover defense is where it's the defense that Iowa State mostly created and popularized, where they have three deep safeties back before the snap. Instead of playing with two deep safeties and then they rotate around and do different things, Iowa State had three. And they would play with three down linemen, three linebackers. Other teams have done it with two linebackers and a nickel, and then three back end safeties.
Yeah, so you basically end up with a 3-3-3 stack in depth with corners out on the outside.
Broken stack, yeah. So that's not right. Like the traditional 3-3-5, but yeah. And then the benefits are you can take away the deep pass by alignment. You can encourage teams to run the ball. Iowa State would encourage you to run. But then even though they had this ostensibly dime-looking conservative defense, most of the guys on the field were big old run stoppers. And so they just close from depth on the run and just invite you into 3 yards in a cloud of dust offense, which is not efficient. TCU used that when they went to the national championship. Other teams used it. Texas had problems with it because this is a really complex topic. Part of the problem Texas had is that Sark wants the deep shots. And if you take away the deep shots by alignment, you're really coming right up against what he's trying to do. So that was frustrating for Sark. Quinn had trouble hitting deep passing windows. That was a problem. I don't agree that maybe semi-solved is okay, but I don't know that Texas actually really solved it. Even in the last time they played Iowa State, they played them well, but it's not like they blew the doors off.
I think one other thing is Texas got better on the offensive line. Before that defense was confounding because we couldn't just dominate running the ball.
Uh-huh.
And if you'll recall, the last time we played Iowa State, that game ended with, what, 14 consecutive runs or something? And then one pass to win the game?
Yeah.
And Tech, you know, Sark has shown that he'll do that and can do that now because he's made the offensive line a little tougher, more physical, better talent. I think that also played a role. I like semi-solved because I think you kind of have to prove every year that you can beat that kind of defense. Let's go to the next part of this question. And
we haven't seen it yet from a team with comparable talent, except I guess Oklahoma ran it last year.
They did run it last year. And
they got run over.
We floundered early, if you'll recall, because we were trying to throw on it.
Yeah.
We didn't execute. Actually, we had guys open. But then we just said, screw it, started running the ball and ran at will. So, yeah, I think the interesting conundrum for this, Ian, is the higher talent teams are not inclined to run the flyover.
Yeah.
They're more likely, like Kirby Smart, to run Georgia-type stuff. And that, I think, is the next defensive mind or scheme that's a problem.
Is there a caveat, though, in that Ohio State did play flyover type on the back end?
Wouldn't call that a flyover defense. I disagree. Because of Micah Downs' alignment, because of where he's positioned, he's not deep enough to be called a true third safety. Sorry, Caleb Downs. I always call him Micah Downs. I don't know why I do that.
I was following. At the very least, you would say that they kind of borrowed some of the like amorphous three safety. You're not sure who's going to be where.
That is true. Knowles, obviously, this influenced his time in the Big 12 influenced this defense. But lining up his defensive ends in four eyes,
right?
The linebacker stunts that were just relentless, that is not necessarily a feature of the flyover defense.
Right.
So
He's his own man.
By the way, I thought Sark had an excellent game plan against Ohio State. We had the best game plan against Ohio State in the playoffs of any playoff team by far.
Hooray.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't execute it, but.
Explain the Georgia frontier.
Here's what Georgia did, which was different. And this may be specific to our personnel, particularly a quarterback that allowed it to thrive. But Georgia said, one, we understand your blocking schemes. We understand your pass pro. So we're going to line up really athletic guys at positions you're not quite expecting. We're going to shade them inside the tackle and then have another guy who's 6'5", 260 standing up outside of him. And we're going to cross them, right? Because we know your protections. And I think they also just manned up outside. You know, a lot of what Sark does is he uses his scheme to get his receivers open. If the receivers are also awesome, that's great. But Georgia was a good example where our pass catchers needed to get open one-on-one in space because our quarterback was under duress. And our quarterback was not well-suited to operate under duress.
So one more answer to this question that plays off of what you just explained is that Arizona State and Vanderbilt both gave Texas trouble for that reason.
Yep.
Which is in that I've already been writing a little bit about this for tomorrow, really about something else, but it just came up. They would play match three, so like cover three with zone matching rules. They'd have three deep defenders off the ball, almost like a flyover, but they were usually corners and a safety. And they knew what route combos Texas was running. And they would pass off like the big interception that Arizona State had, the safety hawked down to take a deep over route, and the corner went to replace him as the deep safety because he didn't have anyone threatening his side. And that was against Vanderbilt and against Arizona State. That gave Texas fits.
Well, and if you'll recall, both Vandy and Arizona State repeatedly blitzed their nickel.
Vanderbilt auto-blitzed
their nickel, like the entire game.
Yeah.
And we never had a great solution to it. Arizona State was more judicious, and they picked, of course, that one spot where it was brilliant. You knew it was coming, and they got the safety out of it, right?
Yep.
So stuff like that, I think, is probably the next phase. The point is, it's college football, and your team is sort of born anew every year, particularly when you have a shift at quarterback, your offensive line, your receivers. You kind of have to reprove that you can solve stuff every year. So schematically, does Sark have inherent struggles with any defense? I don't think so, because it is interesting that in the rematch with Georgia, we actually lit them up in the first half throwing the football because of a couple of adjustments we made. The problem is we didn't get any points out of it. So, you know, you can get into red zone stuff. And I think some of that, frankly, you know, was some of the limitations of the quarterback at Texas.
For the same reason, I'm not sure that the three deep cover three is going to work as well, because Arch Manning doesn't loft deep throws.
No.
And give people time to recover on the back end like Quinn did.
So, yeah, the other thing about that three deep safety thing, because often you have larger safeties in that for run support, just because they're there doesn't mean the receiver is covered. And if you can fire it in, there's a lot of yak opportunity. If you saw what Arizona State did to Iowa State, they put on the clinic in the Big 12 title game of how to attack that defense. I mean, running and throwing the ball. Obviously, Iowa State like was playing their fourth string linebackers at that point, but it was sort of technically or schematically, it was a clinic of like, this is how you attack the flyover. All right, next question. Which of our position units do you expect to rank in the top three or five nationally this year? That's a great question. It actually made me think.
It's really high.
That we don't – it is. And so the answer is we don't have a lot, but I know of one for sure that we'll probably agree on.
I think – trying to make sure I'm not missing any. I'm going to say two.
Okay. On defense, can I throw out my first?
Yep, go ahead.
Edge.
Yeah, that was
easy.
Easy, yeah.
Frontline talent and depth.
Maybe inside linebacker as well. Maybe.
Depends on Anthony Hill. So has Anthony Hill fully transitioned from amazing athlete to good linebacker, or is he still just amazing athlete guy?
He's still more amazing athlete guy, but he's really impactful just as that, and he's now in year three.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to push back on this. Is there such thing as inside linebacker anymore? You know what I mean? As a unit? We don't run a 3-4.
Yes.
Well, but my point is that's a position. Is it a unit? Are there, like, to me, it's just linebacker.
Well, the reason we call him edge is because the edge guys don't have to line up off the ball and read guard.
Okay. I was being too literal. So like inside linebacker was like your mic. And I'm like, well, that's not a unit.
Right. Yep.
So just linebacker.
Yeah.
So,
but linebacker and edge as distinctive units, I think Texas could end up top for sure in edge, maybe in linebacker, not counting the edges.
Is there a better edge room in the country than Texas?
Probably not. I was actually watching Oregon's spring game, and they had a dude that was wrecking everything they wanted to do against their Isaiah World, whatever. Left tackle was being dominated. And I looked it up, and he's like the anticipated backup.
Clemson, I think, is anticipated to have a really good edge group.
Are they spinning one of those dudes down from linebacker?
They
have that one guy back, don't they? Parker or whatever?
Peter Woods.
I thought he was the tackle.
Oh, he's a defensive tackle. It's the other guy, the outside guy whose name escaped me.
Is it TJ Parker?
Yeah, we did a good job on him, but He's a good edge. And then they got a five-star true freshman who is Colin Simmon-ish. So we'll see. But Clemson is going to be up there. Clemson's going to be good this year.
My other one was quarterback.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about the backups, but usually, you know, whatever. I think Arch Manning has a very good chance to be one of the top three or five quarterbacks in the country. Easily.
You know, it's interesting. People are very reluctant to say that, or they create caveats in the question to make sure they don't have to bring up Arch Manning. Like, what returning quarterback? like they're scared to make the projection on him because the thought is, hey, you're just a bus rider who's jumping on the name. Like you and I are very excited about Arch Manning, and it has very little to do with his name. Like
he started two games last year. Yeah. They're almost three. As yeah. people are acting like he's still like right out of Isidore Newman, and we've never seen him play against
spring game guy that was throwing to walk-ons in his first spring game.
Yeah. And plus college football is like this. I did this thing once of like the top returning quarterback every year in college football. The next year his team is almost always worse. Usually because the receivers that helped him get there went to the NFL. And you look at the teams that win the championship, and it's usually either like the no-name veteran who puts together a strong upperclassman year, or the red-shirted unknown guy that nobody wanted to say was the next big thing.
Johnny Manziel.
And then he was. Jameis yeah. Winston. A lot of guys, when they actually win the title, it's before they – Trevor Lawrence. Before they're supposed to, and before everybody always wants to be like, you got to prove it. You can't project college football by waiting for people to prove it.
Right. It doesn't work that way. So edge, 100%. Linebacker, possibly, probably. Quarterback, possibly, probably. I don't have any other unit. Maybe corner? Receiver?
Maybe receiver, probably not.
I don't think so.
Corner? No.
No.
That's probably, you know, maybe safety.
Maybe safety with Jelani, Taff, Derek Williams.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially I think safety Williams. Top five. Very possible. O-line? No.
No.
D-line? I mean, like defensive tackle? No.
No.
Yeah.
That's it. Those are all the positions. Team. Running back, but.
Hey, do you know what?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Ian, if you're buying a house, do you know a guy who's top one?
I do.
You know what his name is?
His name is Gabe Winslow.
That's right. You said that in a very meaningful, deep way. His name is Gabe Winslow. He's a UT grad, over 20 years in the industry. He's got a law degree. This guy really is sharp. He really knows what he's doing. But beyond that, very ethical, very hardworking, and he's a mortgage broker. Mortgage brokers mean they can shop your deal to multiple lenders, dozens of lenders. Whereas a guy who works at Big Bank USA, you fill in the, everyone knows who the big banks are. You work for that lender and you're only going to shop your deal to one lender. And guess who doesn't offer as good or competitive rates or always has little hidden poison pills? Big Bank USA guy. Go with Gabe. Brokers do it better, and Gabe Winslow is the best of them. Every time I communicate with this guy, he's on some reward trip because he had some amazing amount of loans that he closed, and he's being flown somewhere and wined and dined. There's a reason for that. Go with the best. Go with the people who kick ass. Don't go with the people that you happen to know through a friend or who's your neighbor. That's not the best way to go do business in the biggest financial decision of your life. 832-557-1095, 832-557-1095, or go to mortgagesbygabe.com. All right, Ian, let's wade back into these questions. I like the questions that we're getting.
It's been good.
Georgia is Texas's main SEC obstacle.
Yep.
For now, how good will Stockton be with improved wide receivers, and will Georgia's defense be as strong as it was in 2024?
So part one, I think – potentially pretty good. Stockton's decision-making last year against Texas and probably against Notre Dame, not always top-notch. And it's not like he was just a first- or second-year guy. I think he was already a redshirt sophomore.
Yep.
So that is a little concerning. I do think it'll get better when he's QB1 with a system tailored around him. But, man, he threw some bombs last year. As did Carson Beck, that went to the most unworthy targets.
Yeah.
They had one dude where I was like, y'all got to move this guy to safety.
Georgia had a bunch of athletes playing wide receiver is the best way you could describe it. They led the country in drops, obviously. Maybe a little bit of a drop off from Bobo, from Monken in terms of offensive creativity. I think that's overdone a little bit. I don't think Bobo's terrible.
No.
But
it bothered me, though, that they kept throwing bombs to the receivers all year when they had like three NFL tight ends.
Yeah. On
the team. Yeah. And I was like, you can't figure out how to maybe make these guys your primary.
I think that's a very good point. That's probably an example of a coordinator sticking to his comfort zone rather than suiting his scheme to the personnel. Will Georgia's defense be as strong as it was in 2024? I'll lead off on that one.
Good.
They will. And here's why. On paper, 2024 Georgia should have been really dominant consistently. They weren't because they didn't play very hard all the time. It did when they played Texas, unfortunately. In fact, they were super schemed up, and they ran all sorts of stuff they hadn't shown all year. And I assure you, Kirby Smart was like, before the year, like, Texas is the game we're circling. And it showed. And they played really hard. By the way, they had a good defense. Like, what if Georgia's defense isn't number one, everyone's like, they suck, right? Yeah. If they're just a top six defense, everyone's like, oh, what a drop-off. I think they're going to be more coherent, and I think they're going to be a little better as a team, like all 11 playing together. Although I think the talent level overall will be somewhat diminished. That said, there's one team that's always number one or number two in recruiting rankings every year, and it's Georgia.
You know, they actually had a weird deal where Jalen Walker was like this force of nature, but he didn't always have a natural position on the field.
Yeah.
And that hurt them against Georgia Tech, and that hurt them in some other games.
Didn't hurt them against us.
No. It also hurt that whenever Texas played them, their backs were to the wall.
Yeah.
Or, you know, championship at stake. Did you notice, have you watched any film on the Army transfer they got, Elo Madozi?
Yes, he's excellent.
He was a wide receiver in high school that Army turned into an outside linebacker. Tell us, I bet you know him better than I do.
I don't probably. I mean, so he went to West Point. He was good for Army, but a little underdeveloped in that he was still, I mean, he's growing from a wide receiver to a defensive end, an edge rusher.
Yeah.
And he didn't have a lot of moves. He was a little primitive, but the physical skills, like I was watching Army play because Army had a great year. They lost to Navy, which destroys any year at Army, but they won like 12 games or something. Right. And this guy was a force, but you could tell he was just learning the position. He didn't know what he was doing. And also when you're an athlete at Army, you have very different requirements off the field. Like academics and muster, and you at Army, you know, at West Point, those guys take 18 hours a semester. There's no like 12 hours and two of the, you know, 6 year hours or human sexuality and history of rock and roll. You take real course loads and you take real stuff, and you have a major strain of what your requirements are away from the field. He's not going to have that at Georgia. And all he's going to be doing is lifting and working on his skill set. So I think he could be a little bit of a breakout player for them that I'm glad you knew about.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, he'll have to fend off the other five stars that we haven't heard of yet that are just
Right.
But yeah, I watched that and I was like, at the very least, probably like a Sam that's just a terrorist. Like maybe an ironic metaphor for a West Point guy, but next question.
Next. Let's bail out again. Thoughts or projections for OU this year? Well, we got just the guy for that. They seem to be media's darling this offseason.
Well, maybe the media, but what was their – I just had it. Over-under from Vegas, six and a half.
Yeah. So interesting on that over-under, Ian. So the accompanying numbers that go with the over-under matter too. So uh-huh. – I actually bet, full disclosure, when it was first available, OU over 6.5, because I had really good odds on that. Those odds have since softened considerably Now it's like minus 170, which means if you bet $10 on that and you win the bet, your payout's like $6, right? So that's not great for the risk. I got basically an even payout on over 6.5. And if you go through their schedule, they have 4 guaranteed wins. So the question is, can they find 3 elsewhere? I'm also not very high on Michigan. So we shall see about that.
Yeah, I go back and forth on that game because every time I think about one team's offense versus the other team's defense, I'm like, this could just sabotage everything else. And then I do the same thing on the other side.
It could be first team to 17 wins.
Or just which team happens to score on the multitude of turnovers that occur.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this about OU. I think they're going to be a daunting team on script. And what I mean by that is Mateer, he's got a couple of gifts. One, he's a 1,000-yard rusher at Washington State, right, in any given year. And he's fast. He's legitimately a good runner. He's big and strong. So the best comp for him is actually our own Sam Ehlinger. And here's why. Same build, both good dual threat quarterbacks. The difference is Mateer is a better runner, whereas Ehlinger was a better thrower than Mateer. But they're both strong guys that can take the beating, and you can run them 25 times in a gotta have it game if you need to, which we did. The other part is very low turnovers versus usage and pressure. Sam Ehlinger did not play behind great offensive lines. He got pressured a lot. He got hit a lot. He had to improvise a lot. Typically with quarterbacks, that leads to turnovers. Sam Ehlinger did not turn it over. John Mateer, exactly the same. He had a terrible offensive line at Washington State, and he was asked to improvise constantly, didn't turn it over a lot. There's something inherent about him that protects the ball.
Did get sacked a ton, though.
Got sacked a lot, which is a function of dual-threat quarterbacks. People think they avoid sacks, and they actually stumble into sacks more often than not.
Yeah.
What I mean by it being on script is between Mateer, I think their offensive line is going to be bad. I think the best thing they're going to be able to do with their offensive line is block down, have Mateer option the end, and then they'll have Jaden Ott, the transfer running back from Cal. If he's fully healthy, he's a good runner, and he's a pretty good power runner. He grew into that. He used to be just like a home run guy. He grew into a pretty good power runner. I see a world where OU can run their defenses, kind of foil you early with Venables type stuff, run on script, running Mateer, running Ott on option, blocking down, keeping the game simple for their offensive line, and then throwing deep on play action. I think there's a winning script there. If you can get them off that script with negative plays that you inflict on them and you put them in 3rd and 13, I think they're helpless.
I agree with all that. I don't think they're going to run against Michigan.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. So I'm expanding this to the broader season.
Yeah, on the broad sense, I think you're right.
So I'll say OU will beat some teams they shouldn't. You think they shouldn't.
They did that last year.
And they're going to lose to someone you think they shouldn't because they get put off script by that team's game plan.
They need to win that Michigan game, I think, to make the over the good play.
I think that's right.
My big thing with Oklahoma for the last 2 years is they don't have any wide receivers. And that is death.
They think the guy that they got from the lower division who broke his leg that was kind of flashing, they think he might be ready for the season. We'll see.
I think he might be ready because they absolutely have to have him ready.
He needs to be ready, yeah.
He needs to be ready, so they're going to plan on him being ready. Because there's no point in planning on not having him because the answer is you're just done.
So I'll take OU and I'll put them in a bag with 3 other SEC teams who people aren't quite sure to do with. OU, Auburn, A&M, and Florida. And all those teams have their win total set at like 6.5, 7.5. A&M might be 8.5. I'm not sure. But the point is, one or two of them. So the question is not whether they win six or seven. One or two of them is going to win four. And one or two of them is going to win nine. Right?
Right.
The question is, which are you betting on? What's the horse that's gonna you know, round into form, and who's gonna get? So some of these teams, all four, like other than Elko, all three of those head coaches are potentially on the hot seat this year. Napier, Venables, and Freeze at Auburn. If they have a great year, all's forgiven. Yay, we knew it. We knew you were great all along. If they struggle, all three of those coaches could get fired.
I'm with you. I'm going to take Auburn as one of the ones to be good. And then after that, it's a little dicier, but
there's a path for Florida to be a playoff team.
Yeah. I love Florida, but I just know their schedule is still,
it's brutal. They have to beat Texas in Gainesville. And that's a game that will be circled. They're going to prep that hard, and they've got some assets and elements that will give us trouble. So very interesting game. Healthy DJ Lagway, healthy Jaden Baugh. Do you remember that running back for them?
Yeah.
He's badass.
A&M and Florida are tough for me. A&M also has some of the ingredients that would suggest a breakout season.
They do every year.
I don't know if Elko's really got command of things down there or not. He probably will. I would lean A&M and Auburn as the better bets. A&M more so than Florida just because of schedule.
Yeah.
And Oklahoma, the best bet to be the 4-win team. Although they could win seven, and I wouldn't at all be surprised.
I'll say this now. I suspect Florida will beat either Texas or Georgia.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll revisit that prediction.
In so May, prediction is easy. It's healthy.
Yeah. Lagway's health is everything. All right. Next question, sir.
All right. This one was submitted by a person involved in the show. And the premise is this. There's a few schools that are a little more on the fringe in terms of classic football programs with nearby talent and access that have a single wealthy donor that could potentially put them up with anybody in NIL. Texas Tech, obviously, we've seen that. Nebraska is actually like that. Nebraska apparently has a structure where they have this one family where they're like, go get what you need. Pay for it however you can, and we'll make up the difference.
Hmm.
Oregon is like that. Miami almost counts here, even though they are actually in a recruiting hotbed and have been a power in the past.
Yeah, they're weird. They're also, weird. Their wealthy donor or donors always have the chance of going up on RICO charges, so you can't totally rely on them to be consistent.
Much like the program.
Yeah.
Is there another one that comes to mind for you?
Auburn had a period like that, but they've kind of gone now more to just catering to their whole fan base for NIL.
I mean, a lot of
obviously Oklahoma State back in the day.
Oklahoma is sort of like this, but I just feel like they're another level beyond that.
You know? Yeah. So you're trying to say, what are some upstart schools that could suddenly become relevant? So here's the thing. Just because you money whip great athletes and you could put together a pretty good team that way, is that the best way to build a team? You have the Norvell corollary, where one year it all fits and he puts it together right and they are, you know, win the ACC. The next year they go 2-10. So are you attracting an inordinate number of highly volatile players, let's say, by simply making that you money whip everyone, despite the fact that you're in an inferior conference, you're not on the TV as much, you're not going to get the exposure, blah, 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 right? What?
It only needs to work one year, though.
Yeah, it only needs to work once. I mean, you need to catch fire. But I'm wondering, Can you build a playoff team? Yes. I don't know if you can build a national title team.
What about Oregon? Do they count here?
Well, not anymore, because they've done it for so long that they're almost now considered a blue blood, right?
But it's still the same.
But they're still in a major they earn their way into a major conference doing it.
Yeah.
Right? The Big Ten is the co-equal of the SEC.
I think, I don't know if people will think this counts or not. I think Nebraska may be the most likely. If we're only down to Tech and Nebraska and schools like that, just because they have Matt Rhule.
What did that get them last year?
That was only year two. I mean, everywhere he's gone, he's taken a slower track.
Yeah, year three is his breakout year. That's what he did at Baylor. That's what he did at Temple.
He's not a quick fix kind of guy.
No, he tears it down to the studs.
And when he takes – a lot of times when he takes transfers, they are not instant offense. They're not like instant meals. They're like guys that are talented and promising and have multiple years of eligibility left.
They got to go in the crock pot.
Yeah. Crock pot program, Nebraska with Rhule.
So I guess the fundamental question is not just the schools, but – and also, how do you count Nebraska?
I know.
Like, they used to be obviously very relevant, but the last 20 years have been – last two decades have been rather harsh. Also, not exactly a phenomenal natural recruiting base, right?
Right. Nor Tech, really.
Yeah, I mean, Tech – you're a short Southwest flight from a bunch of talent, but you still got to get on that Southwest flight. And you're playing in the Big 12. I think the advantage Nebraska has over Tech is they're in the Big Ten. That's a big advantage.
Here's a question. Is it possible for Texas Tech to buy a championship if they keep – if Cody Campbell is good for it for, let's say, 8 years in a row?
Yeah.
Could they buy a championship? That's probably the better question I should have asked, or whoever was responsible for this question should have asked.
Yeah, I don't think they can build a. I don't think they can buy a national title. I think they can buy playoff appearances for sure.
But if they do that, say they did that two times out of five, could that build enough momentum for years 6, 7, and 8 to put it all together?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it gets back to the larger issue of team building, and if the players you're attracting are only there because of money, you might not be attracting a group of players who are going to fight through adversity or have something else at stake. Or if the season goes wrong early, you take a loss early, you're just sort of like, ah, I got paid. I don't care. That's what happened to Florida State. They sucked objectively. They weren't good, but also they should have gone like 6-6 if they'd tried.
Yeah.
They quit. And being a Seminole clearly meant nothing to most of those guys. So if you're a Red Raider purely because someone bought you, what is it, you know, is there a deeper meaning if things get a little tough for a moment? Are you going to fight through it? You know, I don't know. I think that's hard. But, you know, and you got to kind of hit it just right. You've got to find the Cam Ward. You've got to find the, you know, the AD Mitchell and the Matthew Golden outside. You've got to... How are you going to build an offensive line? How are you going to get defensive tackles? Like, there just aren't enough available in the market, right? Don't you have to have a fair native recruiting base of 18-year-olds that you also develop?
Actually, I kind of like how they're doing it on D-line, but O-line, I don't know. I don't have good answers for you on O-line.
Yeah.
On D-line, they're running the Orlando tight front defense now.
Yeah.
You can use tweeners in it, so I like that.
And they got two good guys. They got the guy from UCF, the defensive tackle. They got the guy from Stanford, Bailey, the edge.
They got a guy from Houston, too, that was really good in that same defense and the same coordinator last year.
That's exactly right. Here's the other factor we haven't talked about. Is their head coach good enough?
Well, yeah.
Do they have Kenny Dillingham? Because Joey McQuire's been a lot of that and not a lot of W's. So is that the guy? Because that's also a limiting factor, right?
I don't think so.
You kind of need to go identify the Kenny Dillingham type to make this actually a reality.
I think maybe Traylor could do it.
Maybe, yeah, that's a viable possibility.
He's done pretty good work in this regard at UTSA.
For sure. He's been fantastic at UTSA. And
they tried to get him, obviously.
And former Traylor assistants have prospered at other big schools. Yeah. That's also a big check mark for any head coach, right? It's an interesting question, Ian. So is your suspicion that they could?
I don't know. I feel like, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I just for the mental exercise, I'd like to think that it could be possible. I also thought it would be possible for my flag football team to win a single game last season, and that was wrong. So
they had coaching limitations, Ian. You know that.
God, they had a lot of limitations.
For those of you who have not ever coached youth sports, the mental strain and stress of it is shocking. The amount of time you spend thinking about it or drawing up plays on an index card, you would be surprised. So
you have such grace for, like, I don't know how many times I've watched like a bad Texas team and been like, y'all gotta stick with something eventually.
Yeah.
You can't just do something new every week. You're never gonna get better. Well,
then you actually coach and you're like,
you actually coach and you're like, this doesn't
work. You gotta try something new.
That doesn't work. If it's not going to work, we need something new.
That's exactly right. Yeah. As analysts of college football, coaching youth sports has been very good for us. It's been humbling. All right, folks, this has been an extended deep dive. We went long, but that's because of your fantastic questions. Hey, make sure to like this video. Make sure to subscribe to the channel. This Inside Texas YouTube alignment that we've got is fantastic. And we know all of you like the deep dive. So make sure you offer some comments and support our sponsors. Gabe Winslow is fantastic at what he does. 832-557-1095. For Ian Boyd, I am Paul Wadlington saying, hook 'em.